Let's go back to the beginning of the railways in the 19th century, because that's the subject of this book that you've brought out this summer, about the entrepreneur, the builder, the contractor, a man called Samuel Morton Peto. We've heard of Brunel, we've heard of Stevenson, but I suppose most people wouldn't have heard of Peto. In some ways it could be argued he was as important as those legends.
Brunel couldn't have got his railway built if it wasn't for people like Morton Peto. He could have had the idea, but it was Morton Peto as the contractor who realised it in bricks and mortar. Peto was a builder. He was a very remarkable man. And one of my issues with this Brunel legend is it's all you ever hear about. And it really does get up my nose, because there was a lot of other people beside young Izzy. Brunel, Isambard. For instance, Brunel himself had a large staff of extremely capable young men who carried out his orders and actually did the stuff. Because Brunel can't be everywhere. So when people say Brunel, I think, well, no, hang on a minute. There was a guy called Robert Pearson Brereton. Absolutely vital to Brunel's and Morton Peto, who built the viaducts and dug the cuttings, his men. He organised it.
So who was he then? Where did he come from?
Peto was the son of a farmer. And like Thomas Brassey, he was a great contractor, son of a farmer. They were energetic people. All the Petos going back, the families got the family tree back to the 14th century. And they were always army generals, managers of big farms. They were always capable people.
So they could put a lot of people together. Do the big work.
They could manage. They were good managers. And Peto's uncle, Morton Peto's uncle, Henry, was perhaps the biggest building contractor in London. He built hotels, fire insurance offices, good, solid, safe jobs. Henry Peto built some of the Inns of Court. Henry was a great... Here it comes. I just got to sort this engine out, Howard. Henry Peto was a great building contractor in London. He owned tin mines in Cornwall. He had wharves along the River Thames. He was big. And Morton Peto finished school at 14 in the approved manner and went to work for his uncle as an apprentice bricklayer. He couldn't stop his bricklaying training until he could lay 800 bricks a day, level, you know. And then they allowed him to start his carpentry course, make window frames, all that. He has to go to night school. He is expected to attend night school after a 12-hour day in the... Because Henry's workshops were all along the banks of the Thames. I'll tell you where they are, where they were, where the Greater London Council offices are, opposite House of Parliament. That was Henry Peto's yard. There you are, except it ain't there anymore. But he had to do 12 hours a day, young Morton, and then go to night school and study architecture. He had to be a fully rounded builder. And eventually, in his last year, he was made foreman of a beautiful house that was being built in Pall Mall.
So at the same time as Brunel in the south and Stevenson in the north are beginning to form the railways, Peto is growing up and he's making money, presumably, in this building trade. How was it that Peto got associated with the railways?
Well, his great-granddaughter-in-law said to me, he was nothing but a gambler. He didn't mind taking risks because the rewards were great, or they should have been great. But that was before he went to work for Brunel. But, he just saw that here was a huge new world. Instead of building a fire insurance office block, he could build a 300-yard, 70-foot-tall viaduct. It's much more exciting, I suppose. His cousin, Grizzle, Thomas Grizzle, who was a partner, after Uncle Henry died, these two young men had the business. And Thomas Grizzle, he wasn't too keen on this railway thing because of the risk. He said, I don't see the need for it. I mean, we're making 25% return on our capital. Why do we need to take any risks? you know, we're doing really well. The Peto and Gristle built Trafalgar Square, Houses of Parliament, the Reform Club in Pall Mall, the Hungerford Market. Hungerford Market was the first shopping mall in the world, I'm sticking my neck out, but very probably because it was about 1834, and it was a two-storey shopping mall with a central plaza. They were into all this heavy building. They didn't really need railways, but Morton was very interested in railways, and he took three contracts with Brunel.
So did Brunel go to Morton Peto, or was it the other way
around? No, you advertise, don't you? You put the advertisement in the Times. You know, we're building this viaduct. Who'd like to tender? I mean, the same as they do it today. And various people come forward and say, oh, I'll build it for X, I'll build it for Y. And Gristle and Peto, it then was. Gristle was the senior partner. They put in a tender as £162,000 to build the Hamwell Viaduct. Brunel made his own estimate of what he thought it would cost, and then see who came closest to it. And Peto got the contract. And then, I mean, Izzy was an awful dictator, and he abused a fantastically efficient firm of contractors, Gristle and Peto, and he wouldn't pay them. They had to borrow £100,000 to keep the job going.
So you're saying that Brunel was a bit crooked?
Well, he wasn't crooked. He was very, very dictatorial. And I've been told by people who have some knowledge of it that he was very bureaucratic in his own private business. Well, he was a bit of a bureaucrat. But then we're getting on to Brunel rather than Peto, I mean. Yeah.
And Peto was the man who employed the workmen.
Yes. OK, Peto. We just check the doors. You got to make sure the train's in order. Yep, we're okay. In we go.
So Peto was the man who actually took the real risk because he employed all the workers, the navvies, and bought the materials as well, I suppose.
He had to do all that, and he expected to be paid on a regular basis. But Brunel, in his contract, he would say, I expect so many cubic yards of brick to be laid per week. And if you don't lay it, I'll take some money off you. Well, you can't actually build a building along those. So the only thing is that when some of these things came to court and people sued Brunel over non-payment, the judge said, well, you did sign for that. So what can I say to you, gentlemen? If you sign to accept that Mr. Brunel's contract and then it goes wrong for you, you did sign for it.
But despite the problems of getting the money out of tight Mr. Brunel,
yeah,
in the end, it was Peto and his company 20. That made a hell of a lot of money in that period. We're talking between 1830 and 1850, I suppose.
And Peto was very much behind that. He also built a lot of London docks. If you can imagine in your mind's eye the beginning of EastEnders, every day, the start of EastEnders with the map, well, everything to the right of the dangly bit, that's all Peto land. That was virgin marsh, and Peto, being a builder, see, he was a builder, and he saw the value in what everyone else saw as rubbish. Because he really was a visionary builder. And he bought all those marshes and turned them into dockland. Well, I mean, he bought them for nothing.
And built the railways that went
through them. And the railways had to go to it. He had his own shipping line that was trading with Denmark, with Norway. The idea comes from the idea of free trade and the Liberal Party and Adam Smith. And the whole idea, don't tax trade. If you don't tax it, the goods don't cost so much.
And in that period of time, they were the radical people as opposed
to... They were called radicals.
The people who were in the establishment...
They were the Tories.
...who wanted to keep the old order, keep the taxes and what have you, so they'd be happy. It was the new men.
These are the new men. And Peto felt he had a mission. There was something of that. He wasn't just there for himself. I think there was more to it than that. I don't want Don't want to go hero worshipping people, but I do think there was something of that. He was definitely into the Manchester Free Trade people, the people themselves, because he married, his second wife was the daughter of one of the leading Manchester school people.
But we've got to say that, because this book, as well as being about railways and building things, it's a bit of a love story, isn't it, as well, between Pito and his second wife?
Yeah, there's this, and his first wife. I mean, one does wonder, because, you see, Pito got his Uncle Henry's business in partnership with his cousin after the old man had been suborned on his deathbed. Now, I don't know how many people know that, but I found it out because I'm a terrible little ferreting terrier person.
Tell us about that will, because it proves, or you seem to have proved, that Pito and his cousins and the people he was associated with, they weren't all sweetness and light were they?
No.
They pulled a little fast trick, so they got the old man's money.
That was a fast trick. But again, you see, with Pito, I mean, I spent several years giving 10-week courses in Pito, and there is always a huge but. Now, Uncle Henry's business was gigantic. His sister Anne knew that he had bequeathed his business to all 33 nieces and nephews. They'd all got a bit of it. Now, that, unfortunately, from the point of view of the business, was not a good idea. But it's Uncle Henry's wish. And that will was lying at Uncle Henry's lawyer's office, unsigned, but it was ready to be signed. Uncle Henry's lying, dying of gangrene. And Sister Anne doesn't send for the will that she knows exists because she doesn't like the contents. She gets a new will written. And the old boy's, well, he's gangrenous. He's dying of blood poisoning. He doesn't know what he's doing. And she held him incommunicado for a week. And not even his clergyman was allowed to see him. No one was allowed to see him until they got that will sorted out.
And they were cooking up a new will.
Well, they cooked up a new will, which left everything to Sister Anne, Morton Pito, and Anne's son, Thomas.
But what effectively happened was that it enabled the Morton Pito company to be kept going.
Absolutely.
And that enabled yet more expansion of the railway.
And so you see, what fascinates me is the morals. Morals are absolutely flexible, because if the original will had been implemented, the business would have been thrown to the four winds. And would that have been a good thing? You see, it's an absolutely fascinating thing. Let's answer this bell.
The other thing that you're very strong on in this book about Samuel Morton Pito is his religion, because he was also a radical in the sense of his religion. Yeah. He was a Baptist as opposed to being Church of England Anglican, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was baptised an Anglican.
But if I read you right, what you're suggesting is that he became a Baptist. It was a kind of religion of convenience for
definitely.
Him.
Definitely. Don't let the Baptist tell you. The Baptists... story on this, because this was another thing, you see. I mean, you have to read an awful lot if you're going to write a book. And I've read the Baptist story of Morton Pito, and the Reverend Chown wrote a little biography of Pito, and he said that after the death of Pito's first wife, he writes, Morton Pito was so devastated and heartbroken that nothing short of a severe, and I quote, a severe course of Bible study was necessary to calm his soul. And having carried out this course of Bible study, he realised that he had to be a Baptist. And he then set about looking for a devout Baptist woman.
But your theory is it's the other way around.
Is that right, it was.
He met this girl.
He met her in the street.
He fancied her.
Yeah!
She was the daughter of a devout Baptist from Manchester, part of the free trade Manchester people.
Yeah.
And it was quite convenient for him to be associated with that group of people.
Not half. It was very helpful indeed to his business.
So he became a Baptist so he could marry their daughter.
Well, yeah, and he was never baptised. because I have really, really worked on that one, and I have contacted the topmost Baptists you can get hold of and begged them to search their records. Said, you prove it.
But you're
saying,
aren't
you? No records that he was baptised. Now, they would have done, because they... I mean, for instance, his second wife, Sarah Kelsall, she was baptised, and Rochdale Chapel has got it in their book. Now, you would have thought that as Morton Peto is going to marry this young woman, not long after she was baptised, now would be a good time for them to both descend into the healing waters and be baptised. Wouldn't that have been romantic? No, he was down in Kent doing a railway tunnel. No. I beg the poor modern Baptist pardon. I don't know what they're like. I've no idea. But those old Victorian Baptists were hard men. But you see, there's always a but. If they hadn't have been astute businessmen, Britain wouldn't have been the greatest country in the world. I mean, I don't know. What do you say?
He married Sarah.
Yeah.
And you've looked at the letters that still exist between them. And they seem to write to each other every day.
He
was away building railways. Yeah. She was either in Rochdale or eventually at Somerleyton, which is near Lowestoft, where they built a big house.
Yeah.
They wrote to each other, but it was a tremendous love story, wasn't it?
Well, she was madly in love with him. Oh, God, the miserable letters that she used to write. But he only turned up occasionally. Well, she had 10 children.
He must have turned up sometime.
He turned up 10 times. But he was only ever there overnight. I mean, some of those letters are really miserable. I think that was meant to be 2 beats. We'll give him 2. Yeah, Morton would turn up on the odd occasion. He didn't spend a lot of time at Somerleyton. He would turn up there, and there is a letter in the book where she says to him, "Your teeny-weeny visit seems like a dream." And he would pop in, and he was gone again. He was a member of Parliament. He had huge matters. I mean, you get a letter from Peto saying, "I went to see the Emperor today." That's Napoleon III, the Emperor of the French in 1850-something. "And I went to see the Emperor today." And that's it. And she writes back and doesn't even mention. She says, "When you pass through London, do remember to get that wool that I asked you for." And he's been going. She never took any notice of his stuff at all. And when they finally went bust in 1866, there is a letter, and it's in the book, and she says, "You know, I have never liked what you do, and I've always wanted you here with me, but you would pursue it. So I am sorry for your trouble." And she's almost like writing to somebody else. It's not a husband, you know.
It's a fascinating picture of Victorian life where you've got the little wife at home and the big man, the entrepreneur, the capitalist, out
and doing
building the country's railways that made so much money for everybody.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. This is the but. And what, because I'm being brought up as a Catholic, full of morals and philosophy and right and wrong, and the truth and right and wrong is absolute. Well, it isn't. And Morton Peto proves it. That will that was suborned was actually the best thing that could have happened. But, here we go, but, it dispossessed 30 people.
And in the book, you say that you can't really make your mind up whether Peto was a Baptist philanthropist and entrepreneur, or just a liar, a cheat and a fraud.
That's right. You can't make your mind up. The bottom line for me is this fascinating thing is what is right and what is wrong, because there are always modifying circumstances. And in the end, I come down on the side of Morton Peto. He kept 30,000 men in work for 30 years. So,
why is it that we forgot about him? Is it in the end, because he went bust?
He went bust, and the Victorians were very, very embarrassed. Baptists weren't supposed to go bust anyhow. The Baptists themselves found it deeply embarrassing. It was a most awkward thing. He was a household name, definitely. He had endowed orphanages, more than one. He had built chapels all over the place. He had civilised an awful lot of navvies. He taught them to read and write. He taught their children to read and write. You know, I mean, he did remarkably good things, and everyone thought he was a wonderful man.
And then these silly people, when they see him go bankrupt, they all think he's dreadful. Gladstone gave him a great eulogy in Parliament and said, what? And then they drew a blanket over him and they never spoke about him ever again.
And Brunel is the one we remember.
And Brunel is the man. He's the man that did it. You know, it's just not like that. It isn't like that. Life isn't like that, is it?
You also mentioned in this book another man who I vaguely heard of, who was instrumental in the early railways, but also been forgotten, a man called George Parker Bidder.
Oh, yes.
Who was he?
Oh, wow. Bidder should never have been forgotten. He was the son of a poor granite hewer who lived in a hovel on top of Dartmoor and hacked granite out of a quarry. And this poor man's little boy, by the age of 7, was at grammar school by public subscription because he was such a mathematical genius. It was in his nature. This guy, eventually, as he grew up, he could do logarithms in his head. Now, if anybody remembers logs from school, there's a lot of tables. And this guy had the whole blinking log table page in his head.
He was a child genius.
He was a child genius, at least on the level of Beethoven, and he had it from the day he was born. At the age of 12, he's at university. But what happened when he went to Edinburgh University, it was the only place where you could get a scientific education at all, he meets Robert Stevenson.
And that's where he fits into the bigger picture.
That's where he meets. And when Robert, who'd been sent there by his father, poor old George scrimped and saved and paid for 6 months university for Robert, well, Robert discovers that this boy of 12 is a walking computer. They could work out the cost of a railway just like that.
But why have we forgotten about Bidder as well then, that he was so famous?
I think, honestly, I think this is why I get irritated about this Brunel thing. What about Joseph Locke? What a bloke. Amazing railway engineer. Absolutely perfect contemporary to Brunel. Locke, who the hell is he? He built far more railway than Brunel built.
How does Pito fit into the picture of capitalism and socialism and Karl Marx? Would Pito have been one of the targets for Karl Marx's philosophy?
Well, you see, this is interesting. I mean, are you misjudging Karl Marx? I mean, the only Marx I've read is the Communist Manifesto that printed about 1845 and then reprinted and reprinted. But Marx thought a very great deal of men like Pito. If you read the Communist Manifesto, he says capitalism, and he was living in England, don't forget, capitalism has produced huge benefits for the workers, and it is the highest form of civilization before communism. But he does actually say that. Now, Morton Pito was providing work for the workers, and Marx complimented him. He didn't use his name, but he complimented capitalists. He did. It's in the book. I find the man completely fascinating.
Would Pito himself have seen himself on the development of society that kind of led to socialism?
Oh, no, I don't think he... I don't think so. In an election, I don't think he ever thought of socialism. What he said in his 1847 election address in Norwich, he said, if you wish to keep the Queen safe upon her throne, give the people work.
So it was
That's
simple.
Not socialist.
That was a simple thing.
Yeah.
He saw himself as being a kind of higher person.
Yeah.
But he was giving to the
lower
people.
He said, if you want the country to remain stable and peaceful, give people some work. Because at the end of his life, he wrote a book which can only be read in the British Museum. And I've been down there and I've read it. And in there, he says, dreadful for nowadays, but not in his day. He said, what is the purpose of the New Forest? What's the good of the New Forest? All it is the haunt of the birds of the air and the animals of the field, a load of trees, chop it all down, build houses, work involved in building houses, build railways to it. People could go to work in the docks in Southampton. Let them live out in the new... We don't want a New Forest. He really thought that if you give people work, but of course, he's at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, isn't he? Not at the end of it.
He's the man who gave us what we've got now.
Yeah,
so to
and
speak.
We are now at the opposite end of what Peto started. And we're in. He was a global capitalist. He worked in America, he worked in Russia, he worked in Australia. But we're at the opposite end of it now, aren't we?